Hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm a registered veterinary nurse and I qualified in 2009 and I'm now a teaching fellow at the Clinical Skills Centre at the Royal Veterinary College.
And I'm Sarah. I'm also a registered veterinary nurse. I graduated in 2011 and I'm now an assistant lecturer in veterinary nursing here at the Royal Veterinary College. Welcome to our podcast.
We're here today with Brian, our podcast engineer, to investigate the evidence base behind the nursing practices that we use every day.
We want to make this evidence more accessible to you in practice.
This is VN's Investigate. So welcome. Our guest today is Jennifer Hamlin, who we'll be chatting to about writing and publishing research. Jennifer is a veterinary technician and a registered veterinary nurse. After finishing university in California, she went to New Zealand on holiday in 2002, and she ended up staying when she was offered a job in a veterinary referral practice in Christchurch. After a couple of years, she gained citizenship and started working as a lecturer in veterinary nursing at Otago Polytechnic.
She is now a principal lecturer and a coordinator in the Bachelor of Veterinary Nursing programme. As well as a veterinary nurse educator, Jennifer has a background in scientific writing, industry governance, and strategic leadership. She is a consultant editor for the Veterinary Nursing Journal and VetStream, as well as the chair of the Allied Veterinary Professional Regulatory Council, creating New Zealand's first register of veterinary nurses.
Adding to the many feathers in her cap, she is currently working on a PhD in education and strategic professional leadership. So welcome to our podcast, Jennifer.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
And so I guess our first question that we'd like to ask you is something we ask everyone. When you were younger, what did you want to be? And did you ever envisage that you would be where you are now?
I think I've always been quite obsessed with animals, really, really interested in really having a close relationship with pets. And so I think from very early days when I was quite young, I was fantasizing about having a pet shop or something like that. And then when I was in high school, my instructors started to identify that I had a real interest in that, and they connected me with some James Herriot books and said, oh, you should read about this vet. He's doing some really cool things. And I immediately really connected with his stories. And that started me on the path of trying to find every veterinary memoir I could find, even medical memoirs. And I really connected with the veterinary profession at that time. I just felt at home when I was reading those, and I was so inspired by it. And it didn't take me long at all to search out a veterinary practice where I could do some work experience. And I started volunteering as a high school student in an equine and farm animal practice. And I can remember those days vividly. I remember the smell of the autoclave and the iodine, and I remember just the new things. Everything was so new, and I felt so at home. And it wasn't very long before I graduated high school and then got a job as an assistant in that practice. And then I went on to work in another practice, and I met a registered veterinary nurse, Eileen. She had trained in the UK, and I immediately knew that's what I wanted to do. And so I left to go and get my veterinary technician qualification. And I really have never left. I've always been in veterinary practice and passionate about my field, but it's been very interesting to be able to move from that assistant position and really understand the value and the passion for that role, and then move on to learning about what being a veterinary technician is. And then when I moved to New Zealand, I was really thrilled to finally be able to go back to school and gain a qualification in veterinary nursing. So now I can call myself a veterinary nurse, because that wasn't an option in the US when I gained my vet tech qualification. We couldn't use the term nurse at the time. So,
Yeah, I think James Herriot's got a lot to answer for, hasn't he? A lot of careers made off the back of the James Herriot books.
Yes. What I found interesting, though, about that is that I found it really interesting, though, that I really connected with that professional identity. He really helped me to really know that that was the field that I wanted to be in. And now when I'm looking and exploring professional identity for our professions, I think back about how I've had that professional identity since those early days. So it's yeah. really been a critical learning point to learn about his feelings and sensations and experiences and connect with those at a professional level.
It's quite nice to be able to have that trajectory at a sort of early age that you really felt at home with that, reading that and then going into practice for the first time. And that was, you know, you thought, right, this is it. This is where I want to be. And then later on discovering that actually it was the technician profession. I mean, they are different jobs, aren't they? So the veterinary technician, the veterinary nursing is different to being a veterinary surgeon, and that you sort of found that later, which I wonder if that existed when you were reading the James Herriot books and you were in practice, whether you identified with that in the beginning.
Yeah, I think I've examined that a little bit in my exploration of professional identity, because there was no mention of veterinary nurses that I can recall. I'm sure there must have been somewhere, but I can't recall. And in the memoirs that I read, there was not the identity for veterinary nursing. So I didn't have exposure to those role models. And to be fair, it was really only about that time. I'm giving away my age now, but it was really about that time that that the world started to use the term veterinary nurse. And so it was very new. Our field was very, very young. And I can remember when I first started, when I got hired out of the rural practice, the equine and farm animal practice, I was really just a dog's body. I was an assistant. And I was inexperienced, and I just basically, you know, I cleaned syringes and swept the floor and things like that. But then when I went and I moved to the companion animal practice, they were hiring me as an assistant, and they gave me this list, a really clear list of things. And I was the person that opened the practice every morning at 7 o'clock, and I got to go in there and take care of all the animals in the hospital. And I loved that role. I had such an important and vital role in the practice. And that was where I got exposed to Eileen, who was the qualified veterinary nurse. And she had such pride for her profession. And I learned at that point why her role was so valuable. And I wanted to be like her. And I think that's a really important connection between role models and professional identity. You need to be able to look inside and see what that is. I think for most people in the world, if you think about what a nurse is, most people would know what a nurse is. Anybody along the street, if you ask them, what's a nurse? They will know what a nurse is and their professional identity. And professionalism over the last 150 years has really helped to establish that. But for veterinary nurses, we don't have the same acknowledgement of who we are.
Definitely. And the same history as well. It's sort of, it's so new, isn't it? When I think about, you know, the people who brought about all the changes that we are talking about, we're still working with them. and I think that every day. I think, oh, we've come so far, but you can see where there are issues and where there are challenges with professional identity. Because you think for those who were helping develop the profession, there wasn't really role models as such at the time. You were lucky you met someone, but not everyone did have that, and it's sort of grown from there. It sounds like you could write your own memoirs, I think, and be that role model for some people, I think.
Yeah, that's probably why I like being a teacher, is I just get the chance to share that passion with all my students, and I'm hoping that they'll be able to pass that along to their colleagues and their clients and the public to help share what a great profession we have.
Definitely. No, we definitely agree. And I think there's lots of things that we could talk to you about, to be honest, in the podcast, but we will talk to you today and start off with a bit about publishing. So I guess, could you tell us a little bit about your time as an editor? Did you have any favourite parts, any surprising parts and any worst parts? Because I think it's really interesting hearing your side as an editor, because we're trying to encourage nurses to publish. And so you're the scary person behind an email address or behind a submission box. So it's good to get you and talk to you and sort of show that you are real people.
One of the things that I find easiest is writing. And I think one of the reasons that I find that easy is because I've been doing it a long time. And I can remember in the very early days of being at university, I didn't really enjoy the writing classes that I had to take because it was so easy and I just wasn't challenged by it. But that early experience, I can remember taking literature classes, and I had to publish in a little literature journal, a tiny little, you know, publication. And my writing was all over the show. It was, you know, I was doing the best I could at the time. But I guess that whole experience has really taught me that reading and writing are really good ways to improve your own sort of dialogue and your own prose. And so that's really given me quite a lot of skills that really can't be underestimated. The more you read, the better writer you'll become. So in about 2009, I was nominated by my friend Barb, who was friends with Georgina Grell at the Veterinary Nurse Journal. And she nominated me for the position of consultant editor at that journal. And I had no idea really what I was getting in for, but I had published previously in the New Zealand Veterinary Nurse Journal, quite informally. And I had also done an honors year at university and had been a research assistant, so I had some idea of the research process. And I also had quite a few friends who were scientists at our local university, and that experience taught me some of the excitement behind the scenes of publication. And so I gained that role as a consultant editor at that time. I didn't know much about the peer reviewing process, but my scientific friends sort of coached me in that a bit. And now, after doing easily more than 100, probably 150 or even more than that reviews, I really have an idea of what I'm looking for, and I can fairly quickly do it, whereas it used to take me several hours to do one peer review. Sometimes I'll get an article through and it's a subject which has quite a lot of really technical expert information, and peer reviewers aren't always real experts in that content, but we need to be able to look and see where there's gaps and to help identify that. And we know that there will be other peer reviewers who are experts in the field, so together we'll come to a consensus about the status of that manuscript. And certainly that experience of peer reviewing has helped me really understand where the status of our profession is in terms of our expertise about writing and presenting for publication. And through that, it's really encouraged me to embed some of these concepts in my own teaching so that my students are prepared for what will happen if they decide to publish.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's such a good exercise, isn't it? Even if you're not editing, just having a look at other people's work and thinking, okay, so what are the strong points? What are the points that perhaps we're still lacking? And sort of having that objective view of someone else's work can then really help inform your own work, because you think, oh, actually, I wrote something a little while back and I did exactly the same thing, and I'll make sure I don't do that in the future. And it's sort of it's really helpful as a learning curve, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And I think also one thing that I think is really useful when growing our professionalism is to read some of the research and publications of nursing. Because no matter how we look at it, we are following in the path of human-focused nurses. In a lot of our processes, we have similar governance. We have similar struggles with professional identity and similar struggles with graduate pathway and professionalization. And by reading what they've done, it gives us real context and historical perspectives about where we might go and where we might diverge from that pathway. And it also is really useful because it helps us to identify aspects which could be researched in veterinary nursing that there are no publications for currently. And that's good because if you read some of the writing from veterinary nurses out there now, you will see that there's quite a lot of publications which are not really hugely rigorous research studies. And that's partly because we don't have the graduate pathways to support that yet. And that's okay, but it does mean that we just need to be aware of where we are in that stage and really start pushing for those graduate pathways, which will enable more research to be carried out in clinics and practices and educational institutions. And then we'll take that next step up. And I think probably having a bit more education in our current educational pathways around scientific process is a really important thing. Because then we start to learn what an objective study is and what a subjective study is and a qualitative versus a quantitative study. And that'll help us to refine our writing and our approaches a bit more.
I think it's definitely becoming more common that veterinary nurses are looking at paraprofessionals or the medical nursing profession for publications when we're looking at our body of evidence and there isn't the evidence there that's specific to our profession and our evidence for the practices that we are using. You know, we're looking at those professions and those publications and it's sort of like a window into not the future, but like, you know, there is more there in the nursing publication so that we can use that as well. And it's good to review it and to look at it. And certainly in one of our other podcasts with Megan, who was doing an audit, she said that she regularly looks at the nursing publications because it just helps to refine whichever audit or research project that she's doing so that she can narrow her focus and it just helps. So I feel like it is happening, but like you say, education is a big part of that as well, and for people to know where to look and have access to those publications too.
Yes, and I think also really, if you think about the respect that human-focused nurses have in terms of professional identity and their scope of practice and delegation and utilization, there's a lot that comes with that confidence of that pathway and the knowledge and identity that really lends itself well to having that improved delegation and that improved utilization and really claiming your space as a professional in your own right. And I think that's something I've been sort of quietly fighting for the last decade, is really identifying that we are professionals in our own right. We're not paraprofessionals, we're professionals. We take professional qualifications, we're accountable for our own education and our own publication, and we're responsible for professionalizing our field. The vets aren't going to do that. The scientists aren't going to do that. The veterinary surgeons aren't going to advocate for professionalizing us. It's up to us to claim that space and to acknowledge where we need to be in terms of pushing forward with our graduate pathways and our identity. And I can't think of anything else in our profession at the moment which is more important than acknowledging that professionalization and that leadership, systems leadership, that we need to make that happen. It's really critical for our our field. It's critical for our publications. It's critical for our education. It's critical for our team and our connective and our cohesiveness as a profession. And that's really, I guess, part of my life's work is bringing that to the forefront.
Yeah, definitely. It's such a big thing. And I think it's going to take so many people to really get behind it and say, this is what we need to do, and making sure that we're clear on, you know, who we are and what we're doing and what we're trying to achieve. And, you know, we have lots of conversations with our students about, you know, we are professionals, and but a lot of the literature may be slightly older, for example, and may reference us as paraprofessionals or not yet professionals, and then that's what gets requoted, and you think, no, like, this, we need to look at up-to-date literature that says that we're professionals and that we act in that way, and then we can keep moving forward. It's definitely in the communication of it, isn't it, and the way that we communicate with others, the way we communicate with each other, the way we communicate with clients is just all about that. We are professionals. This is who we are, and this is what we do, and this is where we're going. And I think the more we're comfortable with saying those things, the more we'll be able to act in those ways as well.
Yes, and also I think claiming that role of professionalizing our field. Mm-hmm. It's up to us to say what we need and how we need to move forward. It's up to us.
Yeah, exactly. And where we go. We don't have to follow the way that we've been going, for example.
That's right.
You know, we don't have to stick to the human nursing model. We can claim our own profession. I completely agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's surprising, well, not unsurprising, I suppose, quite a lot of research in the human nursing field about that, about professionalization and professional identity. And it's fascinating because it's exactly what we're going through at the moment. Yeah. They have had the same challenges and still have some of the same challenges. But my heart is full seeing how they have really sort of claimed that, and they're like, right, we're packing our bags. This is where we're going, and we know we need this as a profession. And now we need to just teach the rest of the veterinary sector about who we are and why we're important to the team and where we need to go as professionals. And we've identified we need this, and this is how we're going to get it. And you know, it's very inspiring to see that our struggles are so similar. And that we can sort of build on that and learn from that and grow from that.
It definitely is. I think every time I feel a bit uninspired and I'm not really sure what to do, I go and have a look at research from perhaps around 20 years ago in nursing, and suddenly I'm like, yes, this is it. I know what I'm doing. Like, I saw things about, you know, how I think it's so interesting to talk about how nursing, all the language around nursing was about caring, and you know, how only women could provide that level of care because they provide that care at home. And you think, oh my gosh, like, I can't believe that this is what was being discussed. But then I'm sure if we look back at our records, I bet they say very similar things. And actually, we need to change that opinion of, you know, it can only be women that care, and it's all only about that caring side, and it's not scientific because it's all about our natural instincts. And you think, it's exactly like you're saying about claiming that professionalism back and saying, actually, this is what we do. And people with interest, it doesn't matter who you are, people with interest in providing that service are going to be able to do this. It's not about whether a woman is better than a man and all that sort of thing. I just find it so inspiring, like you said, to go back and look at where they've come from and then go, yes, this is where we need to get to.
And I think also it's probably useful for us to be able to acknowledge that the human nurses really did not get the leverage for their profession until they started backing it with science. Once the nursing scholars started coming up with theories, the theories of nursing, and really identifying the values and behaviors behind their practice, only then did they really start to claim the identity of the value that they had in medicine. And that's where we are at the moment. We don't yet have the science behind us. We're just sort of dipping our toe in, learning about nursing models and nursing theories and you know, really just starting to analyze what we are and who we are as a profession. And I think that's really the next frontier for us as veterinary nurses is to get the science behind our practice. Because as you say, caring is a really important value, but it's just one of many. And if we don't have a framework to support delivery of care, a scientific-based framework, then we won't be able to enact those values consistently enough to ensure patient safety. So really, it's the connection of that science with our practice and values and clinical governance frameworks that helps us to enact our caring profession. And I think doing all those things at once just seems like a big ask, a big change for a little profession, which seems like our profession's a little profession, a young profession. But I can see that as we integrate each of these things and we develop our pathways and we start doing research about the value of graduate trained veterinary nurses in practice, how that affects patient outcomes, how that affects practice profitability and value-based care, we'll be able to really substantiate the reasons why we are so valuable to the veterinary industry. And that is going to give us a lot of strength going forward.
Yeah, that's such a good point. There's some studies going on at the moment, and that's one of their recommendations is that at the moment we don't attribute the cost that veterinary nurses bring in. And so then it makes it really hard to sort of have a worth in practice. And when I'm talking purely financial, to sort of show to people and say, look, we are bringing this X amount of money into practice, which sometimes is what it comes down to, and saying, you know, we are actually doing all of these things, but you'll see the anaesthesia on the bill, but it will never be attributed to the nurse who's run that anaesthetic. And that was one of their recommendations that will be coming out. And I think it's so fascinating because it's so true. Like, you know, post-operative care in the hospital, that's not attributed to the nurse. So definitely attributing those things as well as, like you're saying, the science and the care and all those different things, bringing it together is definitely where we need to go.
Yes, and I'll probably just have to get off my soapbox in a minute, but I really think that the clinical governance, implementation of clinical governance frameworks is really critical to establishing value of veterinary nurses. Because if you consider clinical effectiveness and quality and safety frameworks, who's advocating for those things? Who's measuring patient outcomes? It's the veterinary nurses who are doing a lot of those things. So it's not just the value that we have standing in the theater monitoring anesthetic. It's all those quality processes that really just are invaluable to the practice and critically important for patient outcomes, critically important for maintaining connections to clients, that consumer engagement, really critically important for ensuring that our workforces are engaged in this process and that we have a culture of continuous improvement, that we have cultures of accountability in our practices, which enable us to grow and utilize evidence-based practice. All of those things really are undervalued and underutilized in our profession. And once we start to engage with those things, our value amplifies. So we're no longer just saying, yes, I'm spending 15 minutes in the consult room and therefore this is my value. The value is so much more extensive than that.
Yeah, definitely.
I think it's that nurses also need to realize their value because a lot of the time we are doing all these things, but actually we don't appreciate what we're doing. And it's not, like you say, Sarah, it's not attributed to a value. So it goes hand in hand with the identity as well. So it feels like a big hill to climb, a big frontier, but I guess we can get there sort of gradually and slowly. And if the more that nurses publish as well and steer their research in areas that they want to improve, and then, you know, that's the, we can, we can move the profession forward in that sense as well, like you were saying.
And I think probably clinical governance is going to be one of the easiest ways for veterinary nurses to launch into that space, because measurement and transparency of clinical outcomes is a really critical aspect of clinical governance. And when we're measuring those outcomes, we're suddenly interacting with data. And when we're presenting them and being transparent with them, we're interacting with that publication process. And that starts to become normalized in our practices until it's really an easy thing then to go to the next stage of publishing that in a veterinary nursing journal, for example.
So let's talk a bit more about research and publishing. So if someone's completed some research in practice, why should they share it? I know we've touched on that a bit, but if they publish in a journal, you know, because I think one of the barriers is, you know, nurses can collect the data and they often have a question that they want to answer, but the publishing part seems to be a bit of a barrier for people.
Publishing is important for our profession to advance, and it's important not to demonstrate how perfect something is, but to demonstrate the issues and exploration of topics and solutions to problems and sharing similar challenges. And all of those things really help to provide a network of collegiality for our profession. So sharing those clinical outcomes is quite important. I think probably in the first instance, you'll get a handle for where our gaps in knowledge are as a profession if you do your homework. If you're interested in something like post-operative temperatures of patients, do some literature searching of the journals and articles around post-operative measuring of body temperature. And that will give you an idea to identify where some gaps lie. And once you've done that, you can say, you can look at another study that maybe was published, and it might say more research is needed in this area. For example, that's a common thing that can be said in a publication. And when you see that, it's a real key to say, I can do more research in this area. What are the questions that this paper came up with? And can I investigate some of those aspects? And that can be a really easy way to dip your toe into the publication area, because you don't have to invent a new study and invent a new methodology and invent new variables and really come up with all that scientific process. You can build on something that another researcher has already done, and sometimes even it's possible to duplicate somebody else's results to see if they are repeatable results. And that is a very valid thing to be able to publish. And it's a good experience to be able to do something like that, because you can get published fairly easily without having to go through too much scientific process in that.
And how would someone know where they should publish it? Like, how would they choose where to publish it? I guess it depends on what it is, but how would they go about with that process of choosing?
I think in other areas of science, there are journal impact factors, which journals are rated in a certain way depending on their level of expert involvement in peer reviews, and some journals have a very, very high rigorous process, and it's very hard to get accepted for publication, such as the journal Nature, for example. And those publications, your methodology needs to be on point, and your writing needs to be on point, and your references all need to be perfect, and the people that are involved in your research need to be, you know, current and experts in their field and things like that. But we don't really have a lot of that currently in our profession. So the journals that we have, it's worth submitting your work to any of those journals that we have. I think the biggest difference is just to know the difference between a magazine and a scientific journal. A magazine is going to publish opinion pieces, lots of editorials, how-to articles, things like that. Whereas a journal is more likely to publish research studies with scientific process and things like that. And some of our journals really post a little both, just because of, you know, we don't have quite the volume of scientific publications to support many, many journals full of scientific articles. So that's something to consider. And really what that means is that you could probably write it doesn't have to be a formal research manuscript that you're writing. It could be a how-to article on how to provide assisted feeding to rabbits, for example. And that's your own opinion. And you back it up with some evidence and you submit it to one of the journals where they publish that type of article. So there's lots of opportunities for getting published.
And it's probably good practice as well to do something like a how-to article, just if in the beginning, if you want to get used to writing for a specific journal or, you know, a specific way, or just writing in general and improving your sort of academic referencing or writing ability. It's quite good to start off with something like that before, I guess, you go into doing a research project and looking at your methodology and making sure that that is robust and submitting to a journal that is more scientific based.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that, like, you can always speak to, like, colleges or universities if you have a connection with them. And just see if there's anyone there that's interested in the same topics as you, because they may be able to support you potentially. So, you know, if you're a clinical coach and you look after, you know, students from a certain college or a certain university, reach out and just see if there's anyone there that would be able to support you. They may not have time, you know, that's everyone's just as busy as each other. But equally, a lot of, you know, lecturing teams, a bit like us, will have requirements for publications, and we're sort of open to supporting the profession as well, because as we've been saying all the way through, they're so passionate about it, and, you know, just making connections like that at conferences and talking to people and saying, well, I'm thinking about writing this, I'm not really sure how to approach it or where to go. These sorts of people, and people in your practice, maybe if you're part of a big company, for example, there may be people there that have already published. And I remember that's how I first did it. I spoke to someone, a nurse that I worked with in practice, and they'd published something, and I said, how did you do that? And they explained, and then I did that, and then I got all the notes back from the editor and nearly cried at the amount of red on my piece of paper. And they sort of reassured me, no, that's completely normal, don't worry, you'll work through it like this. And it was so lovely having that mentor. So I think that's an option as well, is sort of speaking to people. And Jennifer, you can probably expand on this a bit more, but I think a lot of the nursing journals are really happy with that as well, because, like you say, they don't often have that much to publish at all times. They are sort of on the search rather than being inundated like other journals are, and so they're really open and happy to have that chat with you and go through the process and make it a really nice experience.
Yes, absolutely. And there's been many times in the last 10 years where I may have been contacted asking to be a co-writer on somebody's publication because they're not familiar with the publication process and they're perhaps a little bit uncomfortable about how to go about it. And that's fairly easy to do, just over email back and forth, sort of discussing what needs to be happening. And it's a great way to get mentorship, as you say. It's also, I think, quite good because sometimes, you know, your first publication, you don't have to come up with a brilliant idea to write about. If you talk to any veterinary nursing lecturers or anybody who's in a sort of a leadership position and say, are you working on anything that you'd like to publish? I bet you'll find that most people are like, oh, yeah, that'd be great. I have this topic. And then you can say, I can help you with that. And you'll find yourself publishing about stuff that you never thought you were interested in, but it's good experience anyway to do that. I've certainly found myself in that situation many times where I end up doing a whole lot of work to publish something that was never really my top field of interest, but in the process it was quite useful for me to go through that process. I learned a lot. It's a great learning experience, publications.
Yeah, there's so many people with so many lists of questions, aren't there? Just waiting for someone to help them help them realize these questions and ideas.
Yeah, and I think your point there about getting lots of read back on your manuscript, whenever I'm mentoring somebody or even chatting with somebody who's never published before, I say, right, first thing is prepare for the red mark because it's going to happen. And it happens to every single person that publishes. No matter how expert they are, there will always be red marks. And you can't get away from that. And so just prepare for it. And then also prepare for it being somewhat uncomfortable because sometimes people will really kind of question you and push your ideas. And you need to actually be willing to go back, circle back and rethink things sometimes, rewrite things or look at your opinions and go back to the drawing board. Sometimes it's more valuable to do that than to kind of be overcommitted to your ideas and then publish something that's not quite in line with your values, for example.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that leads us on nicely to if someone's picked their journal and then they would submit it. We could talk about different ways of submitting journals, but it depends on the journal. And again, you know, the editors or co-editors, or they may be a contact, for example, at that journal who will help guide you through that process. I know some of them have, you know, almost, it's very veterinary nursing, isn't it, to have a help sheet on how to do this, almost an SOP on how to submit your article, and you can just follow those things. So you'll submit it and then receive some feedback, and like you're saying, work through that feedback. And are there any other steps in that process that you think it's important to discuss from your perspective?
One of the things that I see come through a lot is that a publication manuscript comes through and it is really not quite in the right orientation. It's not organized the way an article should be organized. And I say that kind of broadly because everybody's a little bit different, but there needs to be a logical flow of ideas. And sometimes that's not present in a manuscript. And so I guess my biggest bit of advice there would be to read other articles that are good and read articles that you find yourself not being able to tear your eyes away from. Because an article looks really fancy and uses lots of fancy terminology doesn't mean you like to read it. Even a really high-powered, rigorous scientific journal can be written so well that you enjoy reading it, and that's what you're really aiming for. So have a read of some articles. Find one that's not only professional but allows you to really get engaged in the topic. And then look at their flow, the way that they transitioned from ideas, the way that they wrote their abstract and introduction and the body of their content, the way that they were concise about their ideas. And if you can do that, that really helps to reduce the amount of editing and the likelihood that you'll just get rejected straight out because your article isn't quite ready to be submitted. Once you've done that, though, and you've gotten to the next stage where your article is well formatted and you've had your friends proofread it and your professors proofread it and your colleagues proofread it and everybody's proofread it and nobody can find any more problems with it, then you submit. And then when it comes back, then you have a chance to really sort of look at those ideas. And usually what happens is They're not really picking your grammar and spelling as much as they're looking at your ideas and making sure that your referencing is on point. You want to be using contemporary research, so sources that are current, and also primary sources, sources that have that are quite robust in terms of when you use the evidence pyramid, trying to be actual scientific studies that you're using to reference your work. And then once you've sort of filled those gaps, then really think about the feedback that's given, but also be aware that some reviewers kind of, they have something in their minds, which isn't always 100% perfect, because we're all human. And sometimes you might need to just say back to the reviewer, look, I've already thought of that. I don't want to make that change. And that's okay. And the editor will have a look at your rationale and decide whether or not that's a valid response. So it's not at all saying that the peer reviewers are perfect or that you should make all the changes that the peer reviewers suggest. It's just a guideline. And then just be aware that try not to be embarrassed about the feedback. The editor is very, very used to lots and lots of feedback coming back. Some peer reviewers provide a whole heap of feedback and others just provide a little. So it's okay. And it's okay to go back and forth a few times. And then once it's gone through that peer review process, then the editor will begin editing for grammar and spelling and sentence construction and things like that.
Yeah, I think I like the fact that you say, you know, if you don't agree with it, you can go back and say, well, because it is your work at the end of the day. And ultimately, everyone's working towards the same goal of improving what's there. But it is opinion as well. So it's got to be a positive backwards and forwards rather than a kind of, I don't agree but. It's got to be where you're working together, I think, rather than getting offended or getting upset about the feedback that's been provided.
Yeah, it's a very humbling experience to publish, I have to say. It's very humbling and very, very good as well. I think I'm always trying to promote that growth mindset in veterinary practice, and that's very useful. It's a good place to be in. I think the more I tend to learn and the more I tend to study, the less I think I know. And that's probably a good place to be.
I think it's a bit like a lot of our education processes and how we nurse is that, you know, once you see it in print, you think, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. And you really reflect on it. But then that, again, is only part of that growth. And you say, okay, yeah, perhaps this time I didn't get my argument quite across as I wanted to. Next time I'm going to write in this way. And I think it's approaching it like you would your nursing care. You're not going to be perfect from day one. You're not going to be, you know, the best writer on your first submission. It's going to take a while to hone those skills as it did with your nursing. And sort of using the support of those around you will really help you, and using the comments from the editors and the peer review process will really help you to see, okay, actually, this is how I can improve for next time. And like you said earlier, like not being embarrassed by that and not being ashamed of it. It's exactly as you would behave as a nurse is the same as you would as a writer.
Yes. And just being aware that there is no substitute for experience. And the more you can read and the more you can write, the better you will be. And it's a process. You can't go from A to Z all of a sudden. You have to make your way down the path. And I think I can remember a year where I think I published 13 things in 1 year. Wow. And I was just like, I need to get better at this. And I was just like really intensely trying to, like, you know, test myself out and do that. I certainly wouldn't do that again now, but it was really useful for me to go through that process, and just, it started to be just like a routine for me. And that was a really good change for me to kick over, you know, from that novelty aspect to, oh yeah, this is part of what I do every day. And now I'm much more efficient. I know I can write 650 words in 30 minutes if I'm in the right frame of mind. And if I'm not in the right frame of mind, it takes me about 3 weeks.
That's impressive. Sarah and I often do writing sprints, which is really helpful because sometimes it's a bit lonely if you're writing by yourself and you want to just bounce ideas. And so we often just have each other in the background and write and go, what do you think about this? And that's quite a nice thing to do.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, even if it's on different topics.
Yeah.
It's the most random conversation, but it works quite well.
Yeah. And your language when you write is different when you speak. And I think really connecting with what that language is and really knowing who you are as a writer is quite valuable. And I think one of the things I see come through sometimes with some manuscripts is it almost seems like some of the veterinary nurses that are writing are thinking, oh, I'm just a veterinary nurse. You can see it in their language, in their dialogue. Yeah, oh, I'm just a veterinary nurse. And I can't say enough about how important it is to picture yourself as that veterinary nursing scholar and to write like a scholar, to write for that next generation, to write for that person that you see yourself that you could be one day. That's such a different dialogue. You're owning your messages. You are confident about your messages. You're confident about your identity. And that's so valuable because people that read it will pick that up and you'll be influencing the next generation of veterinary nurses.
Yeah, that's such an important message. I definitely remember that and try and pass that on to my students, because I think you do see it, don't you? And it's sort of, I can't really explain what it is, but when you're reading, you can just feel that they're not quite there yet with the, you know, this is what I found, this is what I want to say to you. They're just not, and it's not always, but it's just some articles or some pieces you just think, yeah, it's a, I don't know. It's a shame, but I think we can definitely get there, and that's a really good message.
I think that professional advocate voice in the back of your mind, that's new, I think, for our profession. And one thing that really sticks in my mind from a mentor that I had was claim your space, claim it. And the more you know about the profession and the value that we have, the more you'll be able to advocate for your space there and to really confidently know that you're meant to be here. And I know pride, you know, we don't want to have too much pride. We don't want to be conceited and arrogant. But it's important to have pride. It helps us to really stand up and live our values and write about our values and be confident in our values and teach those values to student nurses. It's important. We need to own that pride and teach that pride. And I think that's one of the problems that we've had in terms of professional identity is we just, we're meek. We're, you know, we might be ladies and we don't want to stand up and be, you know, unattractive. But actually, you know, those professional nurses, you know, they have their hands on their hips and they're like, right, we know it's going to happen. This is the way it's going to happen. You know, their hands are on their hips and their fingers are out and they're like, right, this is how it needs to happen. These patients need this and this form needs to be filled out. And, you know, it's very authoritarian. And I think there's probably a process that we need to make to get from A to B in that and really sort of start to own that pride, because it's essential for us to be able to move into this sort of graduate and research phase of our professionalization.
I think we've sort of covered it over this whole conversation really, but do you have any sort of top tips that you want to share about publishing, or any tips for the first time publisher, and just sort of summarize that topic really?
I think one of the things I would say is educators and people involved in education, we need to be thinking about developing capabilities for critical thinking and growth mindsets, reflective practice, clinical governance that supports evidence-based practice, and within that, scientific process. Because it breaks my heart when I see a manuscript come through and it's really that next level of science. And the veterinary nurse has collected some data and has presented it, and it might just be 3 or 4 patients, which isn't really a sizable enough cohort to be statistically significant. And there might be too many variables. So again, it's not statistically significant. And it breaks my heart because somebody has sat down and collected that data and written it up and submitted it, and it's just not really scientific enough to publish. And that's something really that's our profession. We need to step up and start teaching about what scientific process is, and start recognizing that to create robustness, there are things that we need to look out for. We need to minimize variables. We need to create some consistency in our approach. All those things are really important aspects to publication. And then really, I think you touched on this earlier, but the mentorship aspect of it is so important. I have lots of students that I've had come through, and they've asked me to help them publish. And that has been a really useful thing to do because it teaches them how to come through and learn how to write and how to submit. So that's been really valuable. And learn about scientific robustness and learn about the evidence pyramid so that you're citing the right types of publications, because that's another thing I see often, people citing magazine articles and things like that, and it's just not quite the level of citation that you should be using to support some of the things that you want to be expressing. So I think probably those are my biggest tips, and read as much as you can.
I think if you have hopefully people enjoy these podcasts and they do want to go back and listen, but I guess if you'll ever get into these stages, you can go back and have a listen to the one that we did on searching for literature and critiquing literature and things like that, where we discuss these topics, because just going back and refreshing yourself before you sit down and write these things can be really helpful. But I mean, you don't have to re-listen to the podcast. You could look at, you know, some research guides and things like that. But hopefully you have found them helpful enough to go back and have a listen.
Yeah, there's some really good top tips there. And I think it's a good place for people to start. And once you start that process, you know, obviously you're on that learning journey, and you'll learn more and more each time, and hopefully, you know, keep on publishing as well. So thank you for all those tips, Jennifer. That's really great. So we've touched quite a lot on professional identity, which has been really good because it's sort of been weaving in and out of our conversation on research and publishing. And it's obviously a very important topic to you, Jennifer, as well. So just to sort of round off and summarise with professional identity, it'd be really great to hear if you think there's a link between building the research community in the veterinary nursing profession, and how that can impact on the collective and individual professional identity of veterinary nurses. So it's sort of, if you could summarise for us in some way how you think they coexist or impact each other.
Early on in my career, I was inspired by reading about human nurses and the processes that they went through to get where they are. And one of the things that really clicked with me was that moment in time where they were no longer just assistants on the wards. They were actually professionals with their own set of unique skills. And that was really the first part of their professional identity. And we are only just now starting to sort of claim that space. And our students now are starting to reflect on their own nursing philosophy and the values that inform their practice. And the more that our students write about their nursing philosophy and identify those values and connect with those values, the more that we'll have that foundational support for professional identity. And that partly needs to be taught in our education systems. So there's that component of it, which is really developing professional identity from day one, talking to students from day one about what is a veterinary nurse, what is their philosophy that they're coming into their studies with, and then to be able to go back and revisit that later and say, what's your philosophy now that you know more about veterinary practice? How is this changing? And also within that, teaching and supporting graduate pathways. We need to be graduate and postgraduate level. We need to start researching the impacts of graduate and postgraduate level veterinary nurses to patient care and the impacts to our profession. And we need that statistical data behind that to support our advancement. And we also need to acknowledge the importance of systems leadership. When we talk about patient-centered care and relationship-centered care, a big portion of that is that each aspect of the team, including veterinary surgeons and veterinary nurses and assistants and all parts of the multidisciplinary team, each one of those people has a role to play in that systems leadership to enforce those clinical governance principles which support patient safety. Those are really critical aspects. And then within that is professional identity, professional development, professional standards. But all of those things together are really important. And we can publish along the way at every one of those stages, which is so exciting. So if we start to think about developing professional identity from day one with students, then we can start publishing about that. The more that we start publishing about the philosophy and theory of nursing and nursing models and nursing practice, the more we start building our professional identity and our scientific literature database.
Completely agree. Just everything you say, I just think, yep, I agree with that. It's just, yeah, it's just getting there, isn't it? Which it's exciting to be not at the beginning, but I think we are somewhere at the beginning of all of that, which is a very nice place to be.
Yes, and I think also, you know, we're sort of pushing to publish, but actually we don't really know what we're publishing. So really having that sort of framework of governance and those aspects of care that'll help us to identify the skills that we have and the values that we have, that will give us a whole wealth of new things to publish about. So it's almost cart before the horse, really, pushing to publish. I think we should push to improve standards. And then as we do that, publications will just come naturally through that. And certainly that's true with advancement of the profession as well.
I think it's been so inspiring to talk to you today, Jennifer, and I think I could listen to you all day long just talking about these topics. And I think, yeah, hopefully we've helped to inspire some other people. And we always say, you know, you can get in contact with us on our Instagram pages and things like that if you have found today inspiring and want to be more involved and want to sort of help to make these changes that Jennifer is so eloquently discussing. So I guess that brings us to an end, but it still doesn't feel like, Lindsay said, like the end at all. It feels like the beginning. But I guess just to finish this podcast off for today is to ask you one final question, which is, what's the one thing that you absolutely love and you get to do every single day?
Learning. I'm always learning. Whether it's preparing for a lecture for my students or writing something for my doctorate or even gardening and pruning my fruit trees, I'm a gennet for learning. I love to learn and I've really sort of perfected the art of allowing my mind to wander down a rabbit hole and really connect with that deep learning. And that's really been great for my development, I think, as an academic and a writer, is connecting with that learning. I just love learning. It's just so fun. And then coming up with questions, going, oh, that doesn't sound right. I'm going to go and investigate another answer for that. And then pretty soon I'm like an hour in. I love learning. It's just great. And gardening.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. Podcast while you're gardening, that's my happy place right there.
Yes, I agree with you. Yes. I have been known to re-listen to podcasts over and over again.
That's okay. Hopefully somebody will listen to this podcast whilst they're gardening. I like to think of that as well. So that's the end. So thank you so much, Jennifer, for your time today. We've really enjoyed talking with you.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Please see our Instagram account for further information on some of the things that we've spoken about today. And that's at VN's Investigate.
And it would be great if you could rate and review this podcast and tell your fellow VN friends about it. So as many student veterinary nurses and registered veterinary nurses know about this free CPD. And we look forward to hearing from you all.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.